You find little things. And so I knew, since it was our first night in this apartment, we're probably going to find something that'll throw us off a little bit. We probably won't get the best night's sleep. So we turned off the lights, and the first thing we realized is that just outside of our bedroom window is like a light on an electric pole. And so it was shining this glorious reddish yellow glow down through our blinds, lighting up our bedroom. So we put a blanket over that. That was good. Well, then we heard this little chirp, chirp. We had no idea what it was, and so we're like, I ignore it. Go like, chirp, chirp. It's like probably a smoke alarm or something. So we got up, and I checked the smoke alarm like in our apartment, and I pulled it off, and it was wired in to our electric grid. So definitely not a battery problem on that thing. So I clicked it back on, chirp, chirp. Checked out like out in the hallway, nothing out there, nothing in our kitchen. Chirp, chirp. It came from the second bedroom where we had all of our boxes. And so, luckily, my wife, who has a phenomenal memory, knew exactly which box it was in, and it took us like 2 minutes to find it. But that could have been really, really bad if she hadn't remembered where she put it. So anyway, other than that, this move went so well. So excited to be with you guys this morning. If you're new, or if you've missed the last couple of weeks, we've been walking through the book of Judges in a series we've entitled The Unlikely. Because as you look at the book of Judges and you look at the people that God has raised up to be spiritual, military, political leaders in the nation of Israel, they are very unlikely people. They're not the people that you would expect. If you were making a Bible Heroes dodgeball team, these are not the people that are going to get picked first. And so these are unlikely individuals that God has raised up to lead Israel. And so today we're going to be looking at the story of Gideon. Gideon is one of those unlikely heroes because his whole life is marked by something. Now, I wish I could say that his whole life was marked by a love for God. While in many respects that's true, that's not the determining factor in every story we'll see. Gideon's life was marked by fear. In every single story we're going to look at, we're going to read how Gideon was afraid. Gideon was afraid to do this. He had fear in this. He was always perpetually afraid. And so on some level, I understand that. I understand fear. We had, growing up, we lived on a small farm in South Dakota, 17 miles from the nearest town, and we had a pool in our backyard, an above-ground swimming pool. But South Dakota is pretty windy, and so you can't keep the pool toys next to the pool. So we had the pool toys in this rubber plastic chest in our shed, which was on the side of our house. Now, this shed had the same problem every single year. Every year, you get these little flying yellow and black things that would infest it. Every year, it got wasps. Every year, a few wasps decided to make their nest in our shed, which would be fine except for one slightly small problem. I'm terrified of wasps. Absolutely terrified. I have been ever since I was a kid. Like, part of that is because I'm allergic to the sting, and so that's an unpleasant experience. But I'll be honest, most of it is because I'm a wimp, and they just freak me out. And so we had these wasps every single year. And so every year, and every day I had to go in that shed to get the pool toys, it went down the exact same way. I'd, like, survey the shed, make sure they weren't, like, protecting the entrance, and then I'd undo the latch, and then fly open the door and take several steps back to make sure there wasn't like the cartoon cloud of them that would come out. And then I'd peer in and peer around, and I'd go over and I'd open up the chest, grab all the stuff, and run out every single time. Now, it'd be nice if like I did that and the next time I was a little bit braver and a little less afraid. By the 50th time, I'm like strutting in like this and I'm like, bring it on, wasps. No. Every single time I get this knot in my stomach when I knew, oh, we're going to have people over today and they're going to make me go get the pool toys from the shed filled with wasps whose sole purpose is to destroy me. And so every time, without fail, I had this fear. And this fear has never gone away. Like, I'm still terrified of wasps. And so Gideon is similar in that his fear just doesn't diminish. It's not like he does something for God, and the next time he's a little less afraid. His fear pops up in every story that we're going to look at. But it's not just Gideon who's living in fear. See, he was raised in a culture that was like this. And we're going to pick it up in Judges chapter 6, verse 1. So we're going to be camping out in Judges 6. So if you have your Bible, you can open up to Judges 6. That's where we'll be camping out. So Judges 6, 1. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian overpowered Israel. And because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves the dens that are in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. As we've ventured through the book of Judges, we've noticed this cycle where the people, life is good, and everyone is prospering, and they are worshiping God, and they are following God, and they are listening to what he has to say. And then compromise, like Rob talked about a couple weeks ago, compromise sets in, and they follow, little by little, they follow less of the God of Israel and more of the gods of the culture around them. And that starts to creep in, and they fall away from God completely. And then God removes his hand of protection over them, and someone comes in and invades them and oppresses them and causes them to be, like, causes them distress, because these are tough times now they're living in. And they eventually, over a number of years, cry out to God and say, please help us. And God raises up a judge, someone to lead them spiritually and often to lead them militarily as they overthrow the oppressors and go back into that first part of the cycle where they are prospering once again, where they're following God once again. And so as we start the story, they've fallen into compromise. They've fallen into worshiping other gods. God removes his hand of protection, and Midian, this nation, invades them. But the way Midian, and explains as we go on, the way Midian invades them is very unique. They don't just come in and settle down and sit and oppress. What they do is they come in with their army and their camels that can't be counted, and they just destroy everything. Like, they burn down crops, they burn down houses, they destroy the livestock, and then they leave. And some time passes, and they build their houses back up, and they plant some new crops, and then Midian comes back, and they destroy the new houses, and they destroy the new livestock, and they destroy the new crops. And then some time passes, and it happens again and again and again. For 7 years, they live like this. And so they're in continual fear of, when is Midian coming back? Like, when are they going to come back and destroy our stuff again so that we have to build new stuff? Because Midian is constantly coming back, and so they're constantly in fear. We don't understand this kind of fear. Like, we have some fears. We have, like, the list of phobias that goes on and on and on. I don't know what the word for fear of wasps is, but I'm sure it's somewhere on there. We have legitimate fears, personal fears, deep-seated personal fears. We have financial fears. We have fears about, you know, our kids and our family and our parents. We have legitimate fears in our culture today, but not like this. This is a fear of, invaders could come and wipe out everything I own and take my very life at any time. We don't have that kind of fear. But in reality, there are people in our world today who do have this kind of fear. We have Christian brothers and sisters who live with this kind of fear, like, anyone could invade into my home, take all my stuff, send my children off into slavery, take my life at any time. There are people who live in this kind of fear. So we need to pray for individuals who are like that, who have that kind of fear in their lives. But the truth is, we don't have that kind of fear. But Gideon does. Gideon has grown up in this culture of fear. And so anytime, as we're introduced to Gideon here, anytime an author introduces a new character, they're going to take care to paint that character in a certain light. Because the first glimpse you get of a character in any book you've ever read is going to paint the way you see that character for the rest of the story. So the author of Judges is going to take special care to paint Gideon in a certain light. So the first thing we learn about Gideon, the first thing we read about him, is going to be important to the rest of the story. So here's the intro for Gideon. Judges 6:11. Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. So the first time I read that, I had no idea what it meant. And so I had to look it up. And because I don't know about you, but I'm not familiar with ancient Israel agricultural practices. So I had to look it up. And when I looked it up, here's what I found out. Normally, when you would harvest wheat, here's what you would do. This was the most efficient way to harvest wheat at the time. You would cut it all down, and the grain for the wheat is stored on the top of the plant, the very top of the plant. And so you'd lay all that wheat down on what's called a threshing floor. So beating out wheat, that's the process, is called threshing. You'd lay it down on this hard rock or hard dirt floor. But the problem is that grain is covered in a shell, a protective shell. And so you had to break the shell off. And so they'd run their oxen up and down and up and down, do all the wheat at once, and then they would have the grain that they could eat, they could turn into bread, they could use for different things. And so that was the most efficient way at the time. You'd also get a little bit of wind in there, and it'd blow all the pieces away so that you didn't have to pick out the grains individually. But that's not what Gideon's doing. That would have been the norm, but that's not what he's doing. He's doing it by hand. Now, part of that might be because the Midianites came and killed all their oxen. But part of it is because he just doesn't have a lot of grain. Like, he's not doing it all at once. He's doing just enough to possibly sustain them for the next day or the next week. He's doing just a little bit at a time. So he's doing it by hand. He's hitting it, some translations say, with a stick. Now, he's also, remember, the wind comes in and blows the chaff away so that you don't have to pick out the little grains one by one by one. But he's doing it in a wine press, which is a 10-foot hole in the ground. I don't think there's a whole lot of wind in a 10-foot hole in the ground. So he has sacrificed all of the agricultural efficiency known by his people at the time for one reason: to hide. Because he is living in fear. So the first thing we learn about Gideon is his whole life is marked by fear. Because he is hiding in a hole in the ground, and that's where we meet him. And an angel comes to him and says, for God, that God is going to save Israel through this man. Through this man hiding in a hole in the ground, God's going to save Israel through him. And this is Gideon's response. Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. Talk about the unlikely. Gideon's part of the clan of Manasseh, which is one of the least clans, or one of the least households in all of Israel. And his clan is the least, his family is the least in Manasseh, and he's the least in his father's house. So he's the lowest of the lowest of the low. And it's to this guy hiding in a hole in the ground that God says, I'm going to save Israel through you. And so it's incredibly humbling to think that God had pick of everyone in Israel, and he chose this person. And here's why. Gideon goes on to have this conversation with this angel, and it says, I want to do a sacrifice. And so he's like, will you wait for me to bring the sacrifice? So he goes, and he brings together some food, and he offers this sacrifice to God on a rock. And the angel touches the rock with its staff, and the food bursts into flames and is completely consumed. And it's easy to overlook that moment because it's a little weird and just think it's not an essential part of the story. But this is the first sacrifice to the true God of Israel, to Yahweh, in who knows how long. This is the first time, possibly in his whole life, that Gideon has done a sacrifice to a true God, to the true God, to Yahweh. This is potentially the first sacrifice to God in 7 years in the nation of Israel. And so before Gideon goes on to do any of the other things he's about to do, the first thing he does is make his life right with God, align his life with God's purposes. His first task, the first thing he does, isn't a military thing, isn't a political thing, it's a spiritual thing. That's where he starts. He starts with a relationship with God, a personal one. So then God gives him his first task. God tells him to go and destroy the idols in his father's house. So his father has a couple idols, one to Baal, one to Asherah, and he's to go destroy these idols, these altars to these idols, these false gods, tear them down, and build up a new altar to God. That's the task he's been given. Now, this is a huge offense at the time. You do not mess with other people's gods. You definitely don't mess with your dad's gods. That's like stealing the remote control. You're not allowed to do that. You don't mess with dad's gods. But that's what he's been tasked with. See, he's personally sacrificed. He's gotten his personal life right with God. Now it's time to get his family in line with God's mission. That's what he's been tasked with. And so here's what he does. So Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had told him. But because he was too afraid of his family and the men of the town to do it by day, he did it by night. So I find two things interesting about this. The first is he was afraid. He was afraid to do what God had asked him to do. He saw the fire leap out of the rock and consume, but he wasn't sure that God was big enough to protect him while he did this in front, you know, did this very illegal act in his father's house. And so he did it by night because he was afraid. But he did it despite the fact that he was afraid. He was afraid, and he still did what God had asked him to, despite fear. We'll see time and time again, he'll be afraid again and again and again. And yet, he still does what God asked him to do. He doesn't let his fear hold him back. He doesn't let his fear hold him back. So he goes ahead and he does this. He tears down these idols and the altars to them. He builds up an altar in his father's house to Yahweh, and he sacrifices a bull on that altar. And the town finds out about it, and they are very upset. And so they go to his father, to Joash, and they ask him to bring out Gideon so that they can kill him, because that's the offense for messing with somebody's gods. And yet, what I find phenomenal is Gideon's dad, like, the primary offense here was against him. Like, these were his altars that he built. And despite that, he protects his son and says, well, here's the deal. If these gods, Baal and Asherah, are real, they should be pretty upset about the fact that their altars are now destroyed. And so they can take care of themselves. You guys don't need to carry out their justice. Let them carry it out on my son themselves. And because these are fake gods, they're not real. They're not the true God of Israel. These are false gods. Nothing happens to him, and he's fine. And so first, he sacrifices for himself, connecting himself to God. Then he gets his family right with God. Then he starts out on his big mission. And he sends out messengers throughout some of the surrounding clans and says, hey, time to meet, time to get together, and time to take on Midian. We're going to rid ourselves of these guys. And so he's got this army amassed, and then he has a moment of doubt. Doubt creeps in. That fear creeps in. And I've had moments like that. I've had moments where I feel like God has called me to something. I feel like there's a lot of momentum behind me. Things just seem to miraculously keep lining up, and then I'm riding this wave of momentum on the mission that God has called me to, and all of a sudden I have a second to breathe, and I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And fear starts to creep in, and doubt starts to creep in. You think, well, maybe God didn't call me to this at all, even though he's having lots of success. Like, he could have sent out messengers to these clans, to these other people, and they could have sent messengers back saying, sorry, we're busy, barbecue on Saturday, so I'm not available. They could have sent stuff back saying, no. But no, he has this army. He's got a lot of momentum riding behind him, and that fear and that doubt sinks in. And so he comes to God with those fears and with those doubts. And this is what happens. 36, verse 36. Then Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, behold, I am laying a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece alone, and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And it was so. When he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he wrung out enough dew from the fleece to fill a bowl with water. And then Gideon said to God, let not your anger burn against me. Let me speak just once more. Please let me test it once more with the fleece. Please let it be dry on the fleece only, and all the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground there was dew. So Gideon goes, and he requests a miracle of God to prove to him that God's got his back. He's being very earnest. He's being very vulnerable. He's saying, I don't think I can do this. I know I can't do it without your help. And so I need you to show me that you're real. I need to show me that you have the power to help me through this. Now, let me tell you what's not going on. Gideon is not trying to turn God into a little puppet that does what he asks. He's not trying to turn God into some kind of vending machine where you can put a quarter in and pull a handle and a miracle pops out. That's not what he's asking. Because the Pharisees, when they would talk to Jesus, the Pharisees would do that. They'd be like, show us a miracle. Give us something. Show us. Put on a good show. And Jesus wouldn't do anything for them. So we know God just doesn't hand out miracles to anyone who asks. But Gideon is coming from a place of weakness, a place of fear. And he's saying, I just need a sign to know that you've got my back. And that's what he receives. And actually, he asked for it twice because he's probably dealing with a lot of fear and a lot of doubt. Because he's facing an army, and God does exactly that. And so now we get into chapter 7, and it's battle time. Like the entire, if this were a movie, the entire plot has been building, and now we're getting ready for the epic fight scene with lots of CGI and fake blood, and like, it's go time. This is the part of the movie we've been waiting for. And so we're on the eve of the battle, and Israel is encamped on one side of a river, and Midian is encamped on the other side of the river, and all Israel's waiting for is the go signal, the charge sign from God. And so God comes to Gideon, and Gideon's expecting like a charge. All right, go get him. And that's not what he gets. God comes to him, and he says, you have too many men. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know that it's a great leadership tactic to have the guy who's wrestled with fear his whole life to come to him and say, you're too well prepared for this fight. Because I don't think that's going to set well with him. But God comes to him and he says, you have too many men for this fight. Here's what's going to happen if we play this out. You're going to win this battle, and 2 months from now, you're going to look at the numbers you had and the odds that were going against you, and you're going to say, we did this. And 2 months from now, you're going to completely turn your back on me, and all the spiritual steps you took on your way to this fight are going to be completely eradicated, and you're going to fall right back where you were when Midian was oppressing you. The only difference will be that Midian won't be there. There will be nothing spiritually different, and that's the most important part of this equation. And so God says, send some people home. So Gideon gets up, and I don't really know how you address 22,000 people at once. I would assume you stand on a tall rock with a megaphone or something. So he gets out his megaphone, and he says, if you don't want to be here, go home. And so he says that, and 12,000 people go home. And so he is left with half the army he had before. He's down to 10,000 people, which is still a pretty impressive number, but considering supposedly, the opposing army can't be counted. He's at a pretty big disadvantage now. And so he's only got 10,000 men, so even if God comes with the charge, comes with the, all right, let's go get him, I don't know that I would want to if I were Gideon. I'd be a little more hesitant at this point, because I'm losing momentum now. And so God comes to him, and he still says, you have too many people. Too many people. And so here's what he does. Instead of just saying, send them home, because we're left with the people who stayed after that, he says, have them go down and take a drink. There's going to be two groups. Some of them are just going to dive headlong into the water, or they're going to stick their face in it, or they're going to lap it up like a dog. They're not really going to care. These people are clearly not in a battle mindset. Their mind is on other things, particularly how thirsty they are. But then there's going to be a different group, and they're going to approach the river cautiously. They're going to have one hand on their sword ready. They're going to be scanning the opposing bank of the river looking for enemy spies. and they're going to bend down and they're going to scoop up water with one hand, and with both eyes open, they're going to sip water slowly out of their hand because the mission is more important than their thirst. And these are the people you want on your team. And so he does so. And that second group, there's only 300 of them. So he has gone from 22,000 to 300 men. The odds are now completely impossible. And so he gets his 300 ready for battle. And by the way, I did look it up. The movie 300 happened after this. So this is the original movie 300. So he gets his 300 ready, and God says, now it's time. And this is how he says this. And I love the way God gives the command. So this is chapter 7, verse 9. That same night, the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. Now, he could have stopped there. He could have stopped there and just said, given it in your hand, go ahead. But because this is Gideon we're talking about, he has a few more words to tell him. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah your servant. God knows Gideon is probably going to be afraid. He's been afraid every time up to this point. So on the eve of the giant battle facing impossible odds, he's probably going to be afraid. And so this time, instead of just giving a command, which Gideon has followed flawlessly up to this point despite his fear, he says, this time if you're afraid, take a buddy. Buddy system up, and now go take him on. And so he does so. They surround the camp. They make a bunch of noise. The opposing soldiers have no idea what's going on because it's in the middle of the night, and they win. And they pursue them, and they have victory over Midian with only 300 people. And so the victory can't go to those 300. The victory clearly goes to God. Clearly goes to God. So unfortunately, at this high point in Gideon's career, things don't go so well after that for him. Because after that, the people of Israel asked to make him their king. Now, luckily, he knows enough to decline. He says, no, I don't want to be your king. But with good intentions, here's what he does. He says, well, I want to have some kind of political authority. Excuse me. I want to have some kind of political authority. So he has them put some gold together and makes a golden breastplate. And this golden breastplate is only supposed to signify a little bit of political power that he's got going on. Unfortunately, it becomes a stumbling block. And people fall to it. They start to worship the breastplate instead of the God who delivered them from the Midianites. And so it's easy to look at this story and say, well, what does this have to do with me? This happened 3,000 years ago. This has nothing to do with where I'm at. I want to take a step back here. I want to jump back to the first task that he was given with the altar, with the idols. So the first task that he was given, he was supposed to go destroy the altar, his father's idols. Well, let me describe a little bit the culture he was living in. In the culture he was living in, everybody had a god. Some people had multiple gods. Some people just had one god. Some people didn't have any gods. Some people had gods that did a certain thing. Some people had just general purpose gods. Everybody had a god. Some people had altars to their gods. Some people had rituals in sacrificing to these gods. But everybody had a god. The only thing you couldn't, and people were cool with it. Like, if your neighbor had a different god than you, that was fine. If you had a different god than your neighbor was cool with it. The only thing you couldn't do was to say that your god was better than their god. That's how wars broke out. When you said your god was better than somebody else's god, like, you had to battle in order to figure out whose god was better. And even worse than saying that your god was better than someone else's god was to say that your god was the only god. That everybody else is a poser, everybody else is a fake, and only your God is the true God. That's a big offense, and you are not allowed to say that in this culture. And that's exactly what the Israelites did time and time and time again. They would say, ours is the true God, Yahweh, the creator of the universe, and these other gods, they're posers, they're fakes. And when we compare that to our culture, it looks eerily similar. Just take everything I said and take the word God and replace it with either the word worldview or the word truth. Everybody's got their truth. Everybody's got their worldview. And mine might be different than yours, and yours might be different than mine. And what's true for you might not necessarily be true for me, and vice versa. The only thing you're not allowed to do is tell me that your truth is better than my truth. Or that your truth is the only truth. That's the only thing you're not allowed to do in our culture today. And it becomes eerily similar to this culture. And so it's easy for me to look at this story and be like, oh, I want to be one of those 300. I want to be one of those guys who face impossible odds with a God who is big enough to support me and to protect me. I want to take on that army with God at my back. And I want to do whatever the modern day equivalent of that is. Go and make disciples. Go and just be on a crusade for Christ up against impossible spiritual odds. I want to go do that. But we have to take a step back before we can do that. Before we can go out and before we can do that epic, awesome battle like Gideon did with the 300, we have to take a step back and look at, first, he had to sacrifice to God as a person. First, he had to give his life over to God. Then, he had to look in his immediate context. He had to look at his family and lead them well. Before he was ever a military leader, he was a spiritual leader in his immediate context. And so before we can go out and do awesome, amazing things that God wants for us to do, we have to take a look at what's around us first. And so I challenge you to take a look around you. Take a look at your families. Are you leading your families well? Take a look at your spouse. Are you loving your spouse well? Are you using your time? Are you using your time well? Are you looking up to and respecting your parents well? Take a look at the immediate context around you. Expand that bubble a little bit more. How are things going at work? Are you sharing Jesus with people at work? Because this is how God works. He takes a little step, little steps at a time. And so that's what I want to leave you with this morning. I don't know about you, but I want to be one of those 300 doing one of those awesome epic battles. But before Gideon could get there, he started small. And little by little by little, despite the fear, like it's easy to let fear creep in. What if I lose a friend over this? What if it costs me something? It's easy to let fear creep in, but despite the fear, he moved forward. First spiritually, and then on to bigger and better things. Would you guys please pray with me this morning? Dear Lord God, I thank you for stories like Gideon's. I thank you for stories that we can look at and we can learn from. We can look at the story of Gideon and how he moved forward and he fought impossible odds despite his fear. And Lord God, first he started by making his relationship with you first and foremost, by putting you first in his life. He started by getting right with you. And then he got that circle a little bigger and he looked at his family and said, how can I love my family well? How can I lead my family well spiritually? And so I pray that you would help us do the same, that you would help us lead our kids well, love our spouses well, look up and respect our parents, steward well our time and our finances, and that that circle would get bigger and we'd start sharing Christ with people at work, with friends, extended family members, and that that would lead us to amazing and unfathomable things, things we can't even imagine right now, but that you would have those things for us. We pray all of these things in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.